Welcome to the MIR podcast. I'm Kathy Posey, a director at MIR.
And I'm Ariana Yupi, Senior Project Officer at MIR. Our mission is simple: open public climate education.
Each episode, we bring on researchers, practitioners, and communicators to unpack the current climate situation across science, impacts, solutions, and policy.
We connect the dots from physics and tipping points to community innovation, youth leadership, and practical cooling approaches, including MIR's ground-based democratic installations.
Expect clarity over hype, evidence over buzzwords, and practical takeaways you can use.
Guest ideas or topics? Find us on social media or via MIR.org.
All right, let's dive in. Today, we're joined by Dr. Elliot Jacobson, a mathematician, retired professor, and one of the most widely followed online independent climate communicators.
Elliot is known for his no-holds-barred approach to climate data, making the numbers clear, calling out misinformation, and translating raw observations into insight the public can understand. His work tracking Earth's temperature trends, sea ice decline, and the planet's energy imbalance has become an invaluable reference for scientists and citizens alike. Elliot presented a very fascinating MIR talk back in December 2024. In the presentation, Elliot clarified the current status of the 1.5C global target and provided insights into the future trajectory of climate action. The MIR talk will be linked in the show notes.
Elliot, it's an honor to have you with us again. Welcome to the MIR podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's very kind of you.
Okay, so we'll jump right into some questions here. Elliot, the 30th annual Global Conference of Parties, or COP30, has just wrapped up in Brazil. After 3 decades of these conferences, do you think they've made a real difference to global emissions or the path of future warming?
Well, they certainly will claim they have. If you read what they've written, they go out of their way to applaud their successes. For example, in the final agreement that was just released, there was a comment that before the Paris Agreement, we were on a trajectory to 4C, and now we're somewhere between 2.3C and 2.5C. And that's entirely cherry-picked information, but I could find people today who say we're on a track towards 4 or 5C, it would be no problem at all. So it's sort of like they want us to believe that they've made a huge difference. And some of the agreements, if they actually worked, would be substantial. But we're still struggling just to get off the ground with the Paris Agreement a decade later.
Right. I kind of feel like COP has become a bit more of a performance than physics.
Well, it's performative, but there's also just on display all of the battles between these competing interests. You have the fossil fuel interests, the deforestation interests, you have methane, you have island countries, nations that are going to be underwater soon. You have third world countries that are looking for some climate justice and more funding. You have so many different competing interests, and every one of them wants to get to the top of the agenda. And the real issue is that you need a consensus in order to put whatever it is that's your agenda item into the final agreement for the COP. And unfortunately, what the word consensus has come to mean is unanimous consent, as opposed to maybe a more vernacular understanding of the word is, say, 70 or 80% of the people agree. So it's this sort of one country has veto power that has really slowed down the process or really ground it to a halt.
Yeah, the progress hasn't really kept pace with the science, and negotiations alone isn't able to, close the gap unless there's underlying change.
I mean, just
Definitely.
for example, in the agreement, they did not mention fossil fuels. This was a big issue. I mean, those two words were not in the final agreement. Fossil fuels, not once, right? CO2 was not in the final agreement, not once. Methane was not in the final agreement. I mean, just this crazy lack of attention to the most fundamentally important details. On the other hand, they did use the narrowing window of opportunity metaphor. So, we have a rapidly closing window of opportunity. So it's just, I don't know. I have lost any expectation that anything tangible is going to come from these annual festivals.
Elliot, we would like to discuss Earth's energy imbalance. Of course, this topic is near and dear for us since this idea and this term constitutes the bulk of our name, Mirrors for Earth's Energy Rebalancing. For those unfamiliar, could you explain what Earth's energy imbalance actually means?
So the sun is throwing all sorts of energy at the Earth all the time, right? We have this bright object sending solar energy, and that enters the atmosphere or the planetary boundary as shortwave radiation, very intense solar energy. If you could just think about getting burnt right out there. Now, what happens as that comes in is there are two ways that it can be sent back out into space. One is that it gets reflected off something. So it could get reflected off a cloud top. It could get reflected off snow cover. In fact, every surface has some measure of reflectivity. There is no black box on the planet, although there are some things that absorb fairly well, like open ocean, for example. So a certain amount gets reflected back. The rest hits the planet and warms, or that energy does certain things. Some of it is absorbed and warms the oceans. About 90% of it does that. Some of it melts ice. Some of it warms land. Some of and the atmosphere, right? So there's all these different sort of components of that radiation that's actually absorbed by the planet and not reflected back. So these this warming of the planet does, however, release heat, and that heat is long wave radiation. So some amount of heat also tries to leave the planet as long wave radiation. So we have the incoming solar and we have the outgoing reflected in the outgoing long wave. And so we have two sides of an equation, right? We have the incoming and the outgoing. And the Earth energy imbalance is simply the difference between those. And unfortunately, what has happened is that we have more incoming than outgoing. And the primary reason is that this long wave radiation, which would normally find an easy path into outer space, leaving the planet, is interacting with greenhouse gases. And those greenhouse gases are not allowing that those long waves to leave the planet as easily, right? And so that's the main reason that we're trapping more heat now than is being released into space, right there, are these greenhouse gases. And your project, the Mirror Project, understands that basic equation as well. And so what you're saying is simply let's increase the amount of reflection, or the reflectivity of the planet. So I think that's a brief summary.
Thank you so much. And this amount of energy that we're talking about is quite hard to comprehend. I heard you describe it before in terms of Hiroshima's per second. And I know you don't, we're on a podcast, you don't have a chart that you can show us, but can you describe perhaps in a way that we could kind of get our minds around the magnitude of this energy imbalance?
Yeah, it's a useful metaphor. So it owes to James Hansen, who first used this 10 or 15 years ago and made headlines when he published a figure that said the planet is roughly absorbing the amount of energy per day, equivalent to about 300,000 Hiroshima nuclear blasts, right? So that made huge headlines, and then it was 400,000. And then you started looking through the media, and that number simply sort of faded from public view. And so I decided I would recompute this number sort of based on current data using information from what's known as Ceres, CERES, that there's a satellite system that tells us the amount of radiation. It lets us compute in very accurate terms the Earth energy imbalance. And when I did that, I found at the time it changes sort of based on the season and so and for different reasons. But at the time, we were about 1.1 million Hiroshimas per day was the update on that figure. So Hansen's number 300,000, my number 1.1 million. Now, I recently recomputed that again, and so as the seasons change, as we have differences in cloud cover or amount of reflectivity from the oceans, if there's a lot of wind, there's going to be more white tops, it's going to be more reflective. There's all sorts of reasons, snow cover and so on, that this is a very volatile measurement. So what I did was to compute a long-term trend line for this, and I just finished this. And the number I came up with is about 350 million Hiroshimas per year is our current number. So again, not per day, I'm going per year here. About 350 million, which is slightly under 1 million a day, is our current rate. So that gives some sense for how much energy the planet is absorbing, right? Again, 90% of that is going into the oceans. But it's still, that's a huge imbalance, and it is that imbalance that is leading to the rapid warming of the planet right now.
Thank you. That is still, their numbers are so hard. It's still hard to grasp, but that is very helpful. Thank you.
I think the issue is that we think in terms of the explosive quality of this bomb, right? And this is not an explosion taking place when I use this as a reference. It is the
Right.
energy of this event, right?
Right.
Which because the event takes place in a very confined space, it's released explosively. But if we spread this over the entire planet, then we just see this sort of much smaller impact per square meter or whatever of just a couple watts per square meter. And you have to do a calculation between the two. I mean, it's a big planet, and so when you get this very small effect over the entire planet, it adds up.
Thank you so much.
And then for our audience, could you further explain why Earth's energy imbalance is such a crucial measure of the planet's health?
So if you think about what it takes to heat the planet, think in terms of putting something on a stove, right? If you have a pot of water, it doesn't matter how small that flame is that's under that pot. Eventually, that pot's going to boil, right? And so that flame is going to boil that pot. If it's a large pot and a small flame, it's going to take a long, long time. If it's a small pot and a big flame, it's going to be very quick. And so what's happened over time, if you use this sort of pot of water analogy, is we are turning up the flame. Every year, that flame is being dialed up a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. And to sort of go back to this Hiroshima analogy, right now we're adding about an extra 12 to 15 million Hiroshimas per year to that flame, right? So if it was 350 million this year, it'll be 365 million next year and 380 million the year after that, right? So we are turning up the flame. And that is the single thing that determines the rate of warming of the planet. I mean, we are heating the planet. We have an actual measurement of the rate of heating. And warming, if we just had a constant flame, then warming would be constant. We would see the temperature rising at a linear fashion. But because we're actually accelerating the heating, we're turning up the flame year after year after year. That translates to accelerated global warming. And that's what we're actually seeing. That's what the numbers are actually showing us, that warming is accelerating. And so the Earth energy imbalance is critical to understanding that. And James Hansen is to be applauded because he's one of the few people who focuses on the Earth energy imbalance as the basic measurement of what's actually happening. If you look at what, for example, COP does, they use the sort of this carbon budget. There's this budget of how much CO2 can be released until we get to 1.5 C. And they can argue, well, we've only re released 80% of that, or we have 100 gigatons of CO2 left before we hit 1.5 C. And it's all very nice, but it's not the real world, right? This data that we're seeing is the actual physical, real world response to these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So, that's a little bit more about where things are with this. And I don't know. Let me know if you have a follow-up to that.
And you've described this imbalance as a kind of heat debt. What happens if it keeps accumulating, and what scale of action would it take to bring that balance back to towards zero?
So the second question is a really interesting one because I just happen to have done a little mathematical calculation a few years back. So we have to understand this concept of albedo, which is the reflectivity of the planet. And so from the mirror perspective, what we want is more reflectivity. We want to make the planet shinier. And the more it reflects, then essentially the less we have to worry about the long wave radiation not being able to escape because we're meeting that radiation before it enters the planetary system by sending it back out to space. So if we just look at the reflectivity of the planet as a pure number, and we go back to the early 2000s, which is again when this series data began, and we compute the albedo based on the data there, and we compare that to the current rate right now. If we simply wanted to get back to where we were 25 years ago, the calculation I did is we would need a band of mirrors, 92% efficiency mirrors, right? Almost perfect mirrors from any standpoint, centered at the equator. 75 miles wide to the north, 75 miles to the south, and circling the entire planet. So, just to return to the albedo from 20 years ago, we're talking about a 150-mile wide band of mirrors circling the entire planet. So, this is sort of talks about how far we are. You say, what would we need to get back to that? That's what you would need, right? So, I mean, one thing you could do is you could sprinkle sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere, or you could put some sort of sail in outer space to block out part of the sun, or whatever it's going to take. But the actual task is many, many trillions of dollars worth of investment to be able to just get back to where we were 20 years ago, and not to mention just the practicalities of actually doing that in any real way.
Yeah, that's
That's
quite
very sobering.
insane.
And but
Yes.
I think the mirror project by itself has a lot of value because, for example, when I put a new roof on my house, I made sure to check the reflectivity of all the tiles and choose the ones that were most reflective. I mean, just from a personal, practical, sustainable point of view, having people understand these physical principles and make choices for where they live or buildings they make, commercial buildings they might make, colors they might, paint a road or a shopping center parking lot. I mean, there's so many opportunities to reflect a little bit, right? And even if that just impacts the local environment, it's of course going to be very beneficial.
Well, I was going to ask if we are past the point where the system can naturally correct itself, but I think you answered it clearly.
So you could go ahead and ask that question. Or I can pretend you asked it and just say something.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there is any credible scenario with or where natural variability could offset this imbalance, or we're just now past that point where the system
Well,
can.
there's a couple things. I mean, one is if we add a series of volcanic eruptions, that could certainly help. I mean, Mount Pinatubo, that explosion essentially was responsible for removing 20 gigatons of CO2 from the atmosphere and cooled temperatures by over a degree Celsius for a better part of 2 or 3 years. So, I mean, there is real physical events that could happen. I mean, if the AMOC were to suddenly collapse, that would change the weather patterns around the planet and certain parts of the global north, including Western Europe and Scandinavia, and right, it would suddenly dive in temperature 20 to 40 degrees Celsius from what they are. And so, there'd be more snow up there. And so that would, cool the northern hemisphere. So,
Yeah.
I mean, there's sort of the planet is remarkably resilient at sort of buffering against the changes that are happening to it. But I still think that but for some really remarkable luck, there's not going to be any planetary event that solves this for us in the short term.
So, continuing with this topic of albedo, you've written about what you call the Great Darkening, which is what we've been discussing, that this steady loss of Earth's reflectivity. Can you discuss more about what's driving that change and why is it so significant?
So yeah, the Great Darkening. I'm not sure if I'm the only person who's sort of phrased it that way, but the graphics of albedo, just for example, in terms of reflectivity, the planet was at about 29.3% reflectivity back in 2003, and now it's about 28.7%. So it's lost 0.6%, right? You might say that's not very much to lose, right? But that is a huge number when it actually you take into account what that means in terms of how the planet is absorbing the incoming solar radiation. I mean, there's just this huge chunk that we've lost. And this darkening is occurring for a number of reasons. I mean, one of the major ones is the loss of polar sea ice. So, as sea ice, there's this feedback loop between sea ice and the warming of the Arctic, right? So, as the Arctic warms a little bit, there's a little bit less sea ice. Sea ice is very reflective. The open ocean it has much lower albedo. And so it warms faster. Well, that faster warming makes it harder for ice to form. And so right now we have actually this very year a record low for sea ice thickness, a record low for sea ice volume. The actual extent was not a record low, but if you actually look at the total quantity of ice and how thick it was, we're hitting new record lows. The same with Antarctica. I mean, you see the climate deniers talking about there being more ice, or this report there that somehow ice is there growing on Antarctica. Well, not sea ice, right? Not sea ice. Sea ice has been taking a dive since about 2016. Globally, right now, we're at about the second lowest total global sea ice ever. So that is one of the things that is impacting albedo. Another is this sort of cloud feedback. We have the situation where the shipping was using very high sulfur fuels forever and a day, and then there is this International Maritime Organization had this agreement to try and clean up the fuels because sulfur, creates acid rain, it creates a lot of health problems for people. You want to get sulfur out of the fuels and out of the atmosphere. And so in 2020, there is this huge change to how much sulfur these shipping fuels could have. Well, it turns out that the sulfur that was being emitted by the smokestacks was seeding cloud formation. And so we're losing all of those clouds that were reflecting, were part of the albedo as well, right? So just this basic law, a change in shipping fuel regulations has caused certain parts of the oceans, and particularly the North Atlantic and the North Pacific, to be sort of extra hot compared to their long-term trends. There's also this feedback with winds, and there's actually a report that this year has sort of been a record low in terms of production of electricity through wind. Because winds are just not happening the way they traditionally have. And winds create white caps, and white caps are more reflective than open ocean. So you have a loss of albedo there. You have less snow cover. You have fewer glaciers overall. Another thing that's impacting albedo is the change in the boreal forests, the fact that these forests are extending further north onto what would ordinarily just be ice and snow, right? Because there is a warmer climate, we have the tree line extending north. So, I mean, there's all of these impacts that are changing the albedo that are driving it down. And month after month, the Great Darkening, month after month, I'm just finding that we're hitting new record lows every month. I mean, month after month for planetary albedo. So the Great Darkening is just this ongoing process of all of these various causative effects leading to a decline in albedo.
Thank you. That's very well explained and very sobering.
It's a challenging time. I cannot imagine what it's like for the two of you. It's hard enough for me. And, this is a moment in time that where we're starting to realize that we've passed the point of no return, where the window of opportunity is no longer open, where we don't have choices that we can make that are going to stop really horrible things from happening in the short term. And I just think that's crushingly sad. And you want to do everything you can, right? But in practice, when you look at something like COP and say, well, we want to do everything we can, and then COP happens and essentially nothing happens, and what else is there? And at this particular moment, the world is so focused on issues other than climate change. It's almost gone off the radar. It's like, how do you pull it back into the attention of politicians, globally, that this is still the number one issue by far above every other issue? It's more important than Donald Trump. It's more important than the Ukraine. It's more important than vaccines. It's just more important than everything by three orders of magnitude. And yet you barely see a mention of it anymore in the media.
It's also connected to everything too. So, for example, what if you have two countries fighting over water resources that were caused by climate change? And there's like health, people dealing with health impacts and relates to vaccines. And I feel like everything's kind of connected to climate change, so there should be a focus around it.
So I actually, one of the very first things I published on my blog was a list of impacts from climate change. And you're exactly right. Among those is an increase in disease, because these diseases are able to migrate out of like malaria can go further north, dengue fever can go further north, right? I mean, that's just one of many different things. But the other thing is, I mean, just for example, what's happening in Iran right now, with this sort of day zero, we're running out of water in Tehran, the capital. There's 10 million people there, and now they're talking about having to move 10 million people. I mean, that is what's going to happen over and over in an increasing pace on a planetary scale, where we're going to have these climate migrations of huge numbers of people, because parts of the planet are going to that previously were habitable are going to no longer be habitable by humans. And so, yeah, it's happening very, very quickly right now.
On that same kind of note, going back to the loss of sea ice and things like that, what does that mean for sea level rise, and what are we looking at or failing to look at in that regard as well when we're talking about places that are not habitable anymore?
So sea level rise is not impacted by sea ice, because it's ice, it's water that's already in the ocean. So it's not directly impacting, but it is still an impact. So for example, sea ice buffers glaciers in Antarctica from sort of calving off and going into the ocean, right? And that is land ice that is wanting to become sea ice. So when land ice becomes sea ice, then you have sea level rise. And so as the ice around Antarctica in particular starts decreasing like this, it's going to lead to acceleration of loss of land ice and accelerated global sea level rise. It's going to be unclear how fast that's going to happen compared to these other impacts. I think 20 years ago, or maybe 30 years ago, that was the main impact of climate change everybody was talking about. Our ports are going to be swamped. We're going to get this huge sea level rise, and so on. But at least for me now, that's a very minor issue, because it is going to be operating in a way that's going to get worse and worse over the decades. We may have 3 feet, we may have 5 feet, maybe more by 2100. The long-term predictions may be up to 20 feet based on the current way the climate is warming. So we're talking about how much sea ice total corresponds to our current level of CO2 in the atmosphere, and going back to the paleo climate to sort of find an equivalent time and what was sea level rise like there. But it's a small issue compared to much bigger things that are going to be happening in the next 5, 10, 20 years. We might get 6 inches of more sea level rise by 2040. We might have another foot by 2050. And that's going to flood some coastal cities. It's going to, and especially, we think about 6 inches and a foot is like not very much. But what that actually means is that the storms are going to be the high tides, the king tides, the storms are going to be where we feel that impact, right? It's going to be these extreme events that are fueled by all the other heat, by all the other energy in the system that now have this additional water to work with. That we'll start seeing that happen. So, in particular, the low-lying islands of the world and parts of Florida and New Orleans, and there's going to be some impacts in this country as well. But I don't personally put that at the top of the list of sort of existential issues at the moment.
Thank you. And I think your point that we're going to see it mostly with storms is a good one. For example, Hurricane Dorian that hit the Bahamas, they had storm surges over 20 feet. It just washed over entire areas of the island, killing people and then leaving salt water on all
Right.
the vegetation and killing forests and after the fact. And so yeah, very, very damaging.
Right. Well, it's going to be even more of that. I mean, these we're up to the Category 6 hurricane level now, where we have to start thinking about that as a realistic possibility every year. There's no indication that it won't even get worse than that over the coming years. We're really pushing the limits of the kind of storms the planet is capable of producing in any physical sense. So I think that you have more energy, you have warmer water, you have all the ingredients there, and a little bit of extra sea level goes a huge way in terms of the damage these storms can cause.
So I have a question circling back on aerosol, loss of cooling from aerosols. Do you think current climate models properly capture the loss of cooling aerosols, or is this still one of the underappreciated blind spots in projections?
So there's this is a big topic, right? This is one of these questions where it depends on who you're speaking with. They'll say, "Oh, the models already have this," or so I think the issue is that there's these two numbers. One is sort of the total cooling impact of aerosols, right? And the other is the total warming from greenhouse gases. And so we have a positive number from the greenhouse gases, we have a negative number from the aerosols, and you add those two together and you say, well, that's our current state of the planet. And so depending on who you speak with, they will say, well, the aerosol impact is half a degree Celsius, and the total greenhouse gases is 2 degrees Celsius, and so that puts us at 1.5, right? Or you'll have somebody else who will say, the aerosol impact is 1.5 degrees. And the impact from the greenhouse gases is 3 degrees. I mean, right now today, which means that if you clean up the aerosols, you're going to have rapid warming of the planet to that 3 degree number. So the problem is that these two numbers are sort of free variables in these climate models. So there's no constraint on these other than sort of paleoclimate references. What do we know from the past history when greenhouse gases had this, were at this level? How warm was the planet? And that allows us to get some baseline in order to compute the aerosol impact. So Hansen and his friends all believe that the aerosols are a much higher number. And then you have people like House Father and those sorts of folks who will say, no, it's a much lower number. And I don't know. I just feel like for me personally, I don't like to put my foot into one of those camps and say, this is where I belong. I think it's a conversation that is critically important for understanding how the planet's going to evolve. And if you listen to Hansen and pay attention to what his group says, they have a very convincing argument that, in fact, it's much higher. And if you actually look at the data and what the data is saying, what is on the ground data, not what are the models predicting, the data actually follows Hansen's sort of models a little bit more closely right now. In other words, that we have a larger overall aerosol impact and larger sort of latent heat from the greenhouse gases waiting to be released. And Hansen called it the Faustian bargain decades ago. This is our bargain with industrial civilization was to sort of heat the planet, but be able to hide that heating with these aerosols. And the part of that we discovered comes with the devil is that these aerosols are deadly to humans, right? They create all sorts of health impacts, and you want to get rid of them, right? So we'll see. I mean, I'm paying close attention to the global temperatures, and the Paris limit of 1.5 C is over a longish period of time, 10 years or 20 years or whatever. But if you look at the last 3 years combined, just the running 3 years, 36 months, we're now at 1.5 C, which is kind of crazy because if you look at the COP documents, they say we still have 20% more CO2 to go until we're at 1.5 C. But there is now widespread consensus that we've hit 1.5. And again, that just speaks for Hansen sort of being on a little bit more correct, at least in the short term right now.
Yeah. It is kind of hard to get everyone to be on the same page.
Well, and in fact, that reminds me, Elliot, of your Mir talk, because that was the entire discussion of your Mir talk was how do they come up with these numbers? Some people say we're at 1 point, at that time a couple of years ago, people were saying, oh, we're at 1.2 or 3, and as you said, there is not a consistent framework for how we calculate these numbers, or like you said, that people like to go with these decadal averages, which don't apply when something's not linear and
Right.
it continues to, be a quadratic curve instead of a nice linear line. And so here we are, as you said,
Yeah.
at
Uh, so,
1.5. So
so I think just as a reminder, there was this huge conversation, like what does 1.5 mean? And it's not defined in the Paris Agreement. The way I compute it is I look at the 10 years, previous 10 years, and then I look at the forecast into the future for the next 10 years. And for that forecast, I try and do my best sort of modeling based on available information. And right now, it looks like at best, I've underestimated how warm it's going to be in the next 10 years. But even if you look at that information together, then the consensus from everything I've done is that 1.5 is absolutely a number we will have crossed by the end of 2026. I mean, you could argue we're there now, but I would not want to take sides on sort of down to the last decimal. But next year, absolutely. If you look at the previous 10 years and the forecast future 10 years and put 2026 as the balance point, then there's no question that we're tripping over 1.5 by the end of next year.
Yes, and then
Well,
continuing to rise after that. I know that also in your previously you said that then by 2041 we would hit two, but you said that's probably conservative as well. And so and that and that's a couple of years ago running the numbers, so and which those numbers have changed.
yeah, I just updated that actually a couple days ago, and it now looks like we're and things always are faster than expected, right? I'm now putting the over under at the year 2036 for
Oh
hitting
my.
two, and 2.5 by about 2045. So I say this, it's sort of like if you were to look back just at when the Paris Agreement came out and the predictions for when we would pass 1.5, sort of the consensus agreement was by the year 2040, right?
Right.
So in 2015, we're saying 1.5 by 2040. Well, here we are passing 1.5 by the end of next year. So we're 15 years ahead of schedule, right? So when I do this math and do this sort of forecasting, every time I update it based on what's actually happened in the real world to improve, to sort of bring the models up to date, it's always sooner. It's always faster. And it's just crazy that we could get it so wrong. And yet, if you were to look at the Cryosphere report, it just came out at the beginning of November. They've say right in there that the current temperature of the planet is 1.2 C. Now, that is ancient history at this point. We're
Right.
not going back to 1.2 C. We're not at 1.2 C. It's a crazy thing to put into that report, and yet there it is. We're at 1.2 C, and what they're already talking about is the damage 1.2 C is going to do to global ice. They're talking about having an ice-free Arctic based on 1.2 C, for example. And we're just, everything is so much faster than predicted. And all you have to do is look at the numbers and you see that, and it's nice to look at the models and have a sense for where we might be heading, based on the models. But when you look at the Earth energy imbalance, when you look at the sea ice extent and thickness, when you look at the daily temperatures, when you look at sea surface temperatures, all of these things are just way ahead of the models. They are tracking the worst case, which is called 8.5. Everything's tracking worst case right now.
It's very, very scary.
Yeah, no, it's no question. It's scary. It's everything that every bit of way we confined to grieve about things in the world, whether it's the loss of a loved one or a pet or a personal piece of property or friendship or whatever we grieve about, right? This is so much harder. And I mean, it's something that just I mean, you don't want to, I can't say I'm obsessed about the grief part of this, but it's with me every moment of the day. Right, of every day.
I know exactly how you feel, and we try to leave listeners with something actionable. And it's when we do a podcast, and you spend so much time analyzing this data that can be so bleak, and you've noted that not a day goes by without thinking about these consequences. What's one simple thing people can do to stay grounded or somewhat hopeful amid this constant flow of alarming information? What do you do personally to deal with this?
So there's two things that I suggest to anybody. One is finding a way to volunteer. Find a way that's meaningful to you to volunteer. I was a docent at the zoo for the elephants. I worked at the Wildlife Care Network here, or volunteered there, rescuing some pelicans. I was at Planned Parenthood here volunteering for them. They had an annual book sale. Just finding ways to volunteer, whatever meaningful. It doesn't have to be about humans. If you could volunteer at a food bank, or you could volunteer to restore habitat, but giving it away, right? Giving it away is the most grounding, hopeful thing you can do. And you're not giving it away so that you can earn brownie points, right? You're doing it, and you're not doing it because you think it's going to save the world. You're doing it because it's honestly the only thing you can do, right? It's the only thing left to do that has meaning in a world that's fracturing at this pace. Is find a way to go out. If your volunteering is organizing, a No King's Day, fine, but you've got to find that. So that's the one thing that I would say. And the other thing is just find opportunities to get out in nature, right? Find your own time and place to get away from humans. I mean, I live in a city and I can't believe people drive so many cars. That just blows me away when I see so many cars. It's like, what? You can't walk, you can't ride a bike, you can't take public transportation, you have to drive. So for me, it's just aggravating being in a city. It's like the actual physical being in a city is so for me, that's really important, is finding time to just be out in nature. So those would be the two things I'd recommend, as far as action steps people could take.
Yeah, I definitely resonate with the city part because I live in New York City and sometimes I'm just like, I wish I could see a tree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have a nice park there, right?
Yeah, Central Park. Yeah.
And New Yorkers do use public transportation better than almost any other city.
Yeah,
So that's a good thing.
thankfully,
And
yeah,
they
we have
also
trains.
walk. I mean,
New
Yeah.
Yorkers walk, right? It's
Yes.
like when I was in New York, you just walk. I mean, just that alone is healing to you, right?
Yeah,
As
yeah.
long as you don't get trampled by somebody walking the other direction,
Yeah,
right?
and then also being connected to nature also has a very strong, I feel like has a very strong impact and wanting to do good for the planet too. And then kind of following into that, what sort of advice would you give the younger generation trying to find purpose and direction in such uncertain times?
Wow, what advice? I just think being educated about these topics, this is the sort of thing, like when I go to a mall, go shopping, go out to an event, a movie theater, when I'm downtown and I see a lot of young people, and it just feels like they're not in tune with this issue. Like this issue is somehow not in their consciousness as a thing that is going to impact their lives for whatever reason. I know a lot of young people do know about this, but honestly, none of them feels like there's a lot who just don't care at this point. And it's frustrating for me to see that, because I feel like that if there was going to be a change, that's where it has to come from, right? And when Greta was doing her thing in a big way, that made a huge difference around the planet. You really felt that there was, when Just Stop Oil was doing their things, when Extinction Rebellion was doing their things, you really felt the power of youth, and that something could get accomplished. So, I would just really, I want young people to keep doing that stuff. I want them to throw soup on statues, not paintings, please. I want them to stop traffic. I want them to glue themselves to airport runways. I mean, all that stuff that got so much negative publicity. And in some cases in the UK, these huge overreactions where these people are actually imprisoned, like Roger Hallam, who was sentenced to 5 years in prison for his actions. So the reaction to that was so dramatic, but I still think that the young people have to lead the way on this, and somehow that's gone away in the last year or two, and it's noticeable. You really feel the loss of that. And I say this, I went to a anti Elon Musk rally right? They had them here in Santa Barbara. I went to a couple of these, and over again, all I would see were old white people at these rallies, right? I mean, my peers, essentially. And I was like, where are the young people? And someone said, oh, they all have to work. And it's like, no, they don't have to work. I asked a sociologist, what's her name, Dana Fisher, who wrote the book Saving Ourselves. I asked her the same question. Where are the young people? Why aren't they at these rallies? And she said that in one of her classes, she asked her class that question, why aren't you going out to these rallies? And the response that she quoted back to me was she said they've lost faith in democracy. They don't see democracy as being able to change anything anymore. And
Wow.
that is a really powerful indictment of the status quo and answers a lot of questions about where the young people have gone, right? They don't believe it works anymore.
Yeah.
Whatever, I agree with that. Democracy is broken. But the young people, whatever they do, I appreciate it. I mean, I personally appreciate it. So, thank you too. And whatever they do to change whatever they can, they have a fan.
Thank you, Elliot. Thank you so much for joining us and for everything that you do to make complex climate science accessible to the public.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure and a privilege.
Listeners, you'll find links to Elliot's data, analyses, and regular updates in the show notes. Please follow, share, and stay informed.
If this episode helped you understand the climate picture more clearly, please follow the MIR podcast, leave a review, and share it with someone who cares about these issues.
MIR is listener supported. Your donations power public education and our community cooling and resilience projects. Contribute at mir.org/donate.
Thank you for listening.
See you next time.